This week's episode of This Week on Broadway is sponsored by SeatGeek. That's SeatGeek. To get a $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about The Crucible. We also talk about Dry Powder at the Public, Hungry at the Public, Broadway by the Year, the Broadway musicals of 1950, as well as Peter's visit to Penn State University, where he was on a panel discussion with Jennifer Ashley Tepper and Scott Miller, discussing, are we in a new golden age of musical theater? Please stay tuned. And welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 10th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critzerland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
So, Peter, this week you were up at my alma mater, Penn State University.
Oh, really?
State College, Pennsylvania. I did my undergraduate in economics and Japanese at Penn State.
Oh.
And at the time, we thought that Japan was going to be the financial powerhouse of the world, you know, back in the early 90s or so.
That didn't happen, huh?
No, it didn't really happen.
Okay.
So, but you were there talking about the other great economic powerhouse, Broadway and live theater. So tell us, what were you doing in State College?
Well, there was a wonderful seminar put together by Richard Beaver there, who asked me, Jennifer Ashley Tepper, and who's at 54 Below, and Scott Miller, who's at New Line Theater in St. Louis, Missouri, to come up and talk about the golden age of musicals, whether we're in one now or we're not. Mm. And Scott and I, who like each other immeasurably and see eye to eye both on religion and politics, don't see eye to eye on musical theater. And we had a nice spirited discussion. And by the way, we left the best of friends. I mean, we always will be. But we do have differences of opinions on what musicals should be. And I brought up my usual standard objection that we don't have much rhyme today. And he feels that isn't important because people are used to not having rhyme in pop music. And I rebutted by saying, yes, but a pop record is different because you can listen to it at your leisure. When you have the record, you can listen over and over again. You can certainly hear it on the radio over and over again. There are many ways to hear a record and become accustomed to it. But in the theater, you only get information once, and I do think rhyme helps to keep people aware of the story. And I brought up my standard objection with Spring Awakening, saying that out of 111 weeks that it was on Broadway, that it only sold out 3 weeks, and the revival never sold out at all. And why is it that a show that get rave review, and of course the original got so many Tonys, including Best Musical, that you would really think that such a show would at least be a hot ticket for a while? You know, most of them are. Why not? And I really believe that it has to do with the fact that every time you don't understand what's being said, and again, rhyme helps you to understand, it takes away a little bit of your enjoyment. So instead of coming out and saying, wow, that was great, and I'm going to call all my friends and tell them to go, you come out and you say, oh, that was all right. So I think that, we did battle with that. And also, he's not at all a fan of Rodgers and Hammerstein shows and feels about
and yes.
Feels that they're not relevant to today's society. Whether they are or not, it doesn't matter a damn to me, because my feeling is I love seeing old shows. I do not believe in the term dated, but I love seeing old shows because it tells us where we were in time and what was on people's minds. And that's valuable to me. They're strange type of time machines, these old shows. And by the way, if they're not relevant to today, how did South Pacific do so well? How was King and I doing so well? He even admitted that I think it was the Muni he was talking about, which is an 11,000 seat theater, outdoor theater in St. Louis. It's amazing that it still exists, and it's a terrific place, except when you got to get out at the end parking lot. But what he you know, he was saying that he congratulated the powers that be 1 year for not doing any Rodgers and Hammerstein, and they said, "Yeah, and we're suffering for it because we're not selling nearly as many tickets as we usually do." So anyway, a nice discussion. Jennifer Ashley Tepper really astonishes me with her knowledge. I mean, she has such respect for the past. There was a production of Hair there, and we went to see it. And there was talk about, in the original production of Hair, how one actor was really had the misfortune of being in a fire and died. And I brought up that his name was Lamont Washington. And she said, yes, he was Sammy Davis's understudy in Golden Boy. Now, for a young woman to know the name of an understudy of a show 52 years ago that isn't really a classic show, I'm impressed. You know, so she really does know her history. We drove out together. In fact, she stayed out there, but we drove out together. And I had said to her in advance, listen, you know, I have a lot of obscure CDs. Let me know what you're going to want to hear. And she said, oh, I'll leave it to you. And at that point, I even thought, you know, I wonder if we're going to need CDs. And about 3 hours into the journey, I said, you know, we haven't played a CD. She said, I knew we wouldn't. I knew we'd just be talking. And so it was just great. She really, really is one of the smartest people I've ever known in terms of paying attention to what happened in the past. So so a good time was had by all. And it was really great. Also in the audience was Richard Roland, who's the son of Steve Roland, who was in 110 The Shade. And I had a ball, which is where he met his wife, who had also appeared in Keen, Jenny, and Mr. President. So there was a lot of nice talk about those shows, too. So it really was quite nice, and I hope we do it every year, because it would be nice to be there again, since it is such a charming town. And it would be very nice to be able to drive out with Jennifer again, because she's so smart.
I think there should be a whole television series of driving around with Jennifer Ashley Tepper.
Good idea. Sign me up. I'll be a supporting player.
You know, she is somebody who I love to see her Facebook post, and she talks about how she was from Florida and got up to New York to see shows, and she cleans out her closets occasionally and brings out things. You know, she brings out playbills. She must have been 5 or 6 years old when these shows played, and she remembers everything about it. Just brilliant. Yeah, and
she does.
Her passion shines through everywhere that she does. Oh, that's so exciting. I'm glad that it was such a wonderful experience.
It really was.
Speaking of Hair, a friend of mine, an actor friend, told me he was going to see a Catholic boys' high school production of Hair this weekend.
What?
So we will... I will get the report from him, and I will pass it on to you folks and to our listeners.
Well, that brings up something else. You know, there's Scott and I were sitting next to each other, and he's an authority on Hair. He's written a book on Hair. He's directed Hair more than once. I mean, he really knows his Hair. So anyway, I said to him before it started, I said, do you think they'll do the nudity? And he said, I don't know. And I said, I'm going to bet they're not, because this is a college production. And Aubrey Berg at Cincinnati Conservatory of Music did Hair a few years ago and said, we're having no nudity. I am not going to listen to parents tell me I did this to their kids. Well, Penn State did the nudity, you know, say what you will. So it was there. I will admit the stage got awfully dark, but still they did the nudity. Of course, Hair is always dark on the stage with the nudity, right. But this was especially low wattage, so they didn't tax their electric bill this month with that scene in Hair. So I was still surprised to see it, you know, and but
Peter,
nice production. Go ahead.
When I was at Penn State, I did Pirates of Penzance, and we were mostly nude.
Yeah. I'll tell you, you were a big hit, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, it was a huge hit.
Yeah, that theater was sold out. I wonder if it was simply the nudity that did it. But
which theater was it at the at Penn State? There's like 6 theaters on campus.
It was called the Downtown.
Oh, I don't know that one. They might have renamed other.
Yeah.
How many seats approximately?
354.
300? Yeah, okay. So I knew which one it is.
It's an art gallery. There's an art gallery before you get to the theater.
Yeah, yeah. More importantly, did you go to the Creamery right next to the theater, which is the Penn State, you know, is where Ben and Jerry learned to make ice cream.
Is that right?
Yeah. Penn State University used to be Farmers College. It was a dairy specialist, and ice cream development is big on campus there.
Well, we did go next door, but next door was a Panera Bread. Now, it's entirely possible the creamery was on the other side.
Yeah.
But if you're standing in front of the theater to the left, we were in a Panera Bread. So I hope
that's... Oh, the creamery is to the right. Yeah.
Okay. Ever to the right.
Yeah.
So we should have gone to the left. You know what I mean? So, but they didn't take us there. So I guess they took one look at us and said, we're just a little too heavy. So let's just...
Michael, what were you going to say?
Oh, just before we move on briefly, that thing about the relevance of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, I just have to say briefly, that is ridiculous. Today, actually, the 10th at 3 p.m., I'm taking part in a program at the Leonard Nimoy Thalia at Symphony Space called The King and I From Page to Stage with Ted Chapin. And performances by Karen Ziemba and Francis Jew, and Marnie Nixon's going to be with us. So I've been doing a lot of research about it. And I mean, I could go on and on, but let me just say, for example, in The King and I, they make the point, aside from the culture clash between the British and the Siamese, they also make the point about the racism within the Siamese society against the Burmese, which is something that, is certainly, sadly, very, very relevant to that kind of thing that's much more complicated than the kind of racism we normally think of. Mm. And then there's also a wonderful moment in The King and I when, the king is reading about Moses, and he says, how can I learn anything if I read in one book that the world was created in 7 days, and if I read in another English book that the world was created it took many centuries to create the world. And Anna says this incredibly wonderful line. She says, The Bible was not written by men of science, but by men of faith. Mm-hmm. It's their explanation for the miracle of creation, which is the same miracle whether it took 7 days or many centuries. Now, how much more succinct could that be? What a wonderful line, and I think that's still relevant today. And
well, yeah, in intelligent design circles, certainly. And as I said on the stage there to Scott, I said, Scott, I still think there are people who can go into that theater who have opinions about race and may have some second thoughts about them after they hear Carefully Taught. It's not as if that battle has been totally won. So I think it's good for people to still hear that. And but even if not, even if it wasn't relevant, let's see what people were thinking back.
Exactly.
But what's wrong with that? I mean, I find that fascinating. It's another way of looking at history. So what people were writing is history in its own way. So go ahead.
I've had more than a few conversations with people about how men treat women in the Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, whether it be Carousel or, I know it's not Rodgers and Hammerstein, but Showboat and various musicals of that era. And I think that people are sticking their heads in the ground if they feel that, sometimes in relationships today, men are still treating women like that. And these are important things to talk about and bring out. And again, if Rodgers and Hammerstein was not relevant, as you pointed out, people wouldn't be doing it today.
Right. Yeah, and as I also said to Scott, 20 years from now, you're going to be in the chair that I'm in, and there's going to be somebody like you over there, saying, mocking the shows that you are holding dear right now. Just as when I was a kid, so many older people were saying, Floridora, that was a show. Some of it is generational, no question about it. But and where you start and what you fall in love with at the beginning is certainly important. And I understand all that. But all we know is that here it is 60 plus years after. And these Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, at least 5 of them, are still being done. We'll see if some of the shows that Scott loves, such as Avenue X, I don't mean Avenue Q, I mean Avenue X, will be done 40, 50, 60 years from now.
All right. And just before we get off of Rodgers and Hammerstein, I want to mention that next week we're going to be speaking with Jose Lana, who is going back into The King and I temporarily as the King. And I'm looking forward to talking with him about his multiple Broadway appearances in his upcoming album. This week's episode of This Week on Broadway has been sponsored by SeatGeek. That's SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the hassle out of shopping for tickets. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on other sites into one place so you have time to pick the right tickets for yourself. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based upon value so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. And best of all, SeatGeek is honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticketing sites, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Don't we hate those checkout fees? Like pickup fee and printing fee and all the other fees. It makes me mad whenever I buy a ticket. Broadway Radio listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get this $20 rebate, do this. Download the free SeatGeek app on your iPhone, your Android device, your iPad, various different devices. Go to the settings tab and add a promo code. Enter the promo code BR20. That's B as in Broadway, R as in radio, and the number 20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter the code BR20 today. Thank you so much to SeatGeek for sponsoring Broadway Radio. And if you love Broadway Radio, really, download their app and check it out to support the sponsors who support Broadway Radio. Thanks so much. So let's start off with our reviews. Last week, Peter talked about The Crucible, and in this past 7 days, Michael and I have gotten a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you tell us what you thought about The Crucible?
I really object to the whole concept of the production. I think there were many good things in it, including all of the performances except one, which was a major exception, which I'll get to. But I cannot understand what this director was thinking of. I find it quite different. The director, by the way, being Ivo van Hove. I find it quite different from his approach to A View from the Bridge a few months ago, because although I had some issues with that production, I think that was much more about really taking the text down to the bare essentials and basically removing all sense of specifics in terms of specific location, specific style of speech, dress, sets, etc. And I think that's, you know, that is one approach that he took for that. And I think it's a very different approach from the one he takes in The Crucible, where he's basically grafting another reality onto what the play is supposed to be, and not even consistently. It's the setting is what looks like pretty much a modern day schoolroom in, I suppose, a girls' school, because most of the central characters who are young people are girls, and the cast is in modern dress, but it's still the lines and everything else is still supposed to be like everything is happening in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692 or whatever it is. And I just do not get the point. Every single line has nothing to do with anything that would be happening in the modern day. And here's the thing. I mean, in 1692, the fear of witchcraft was a very, very real thing, tragically, as we know from history. So that is something that people thought was real and they feared it. And that was the scapegoat that was used in at that time. Now, when Arthur Miller wrote a play in the 1950s about he wanted to write a play as a basically a parable for the McCarthy hearings, the anti-communist purge in America at that time, he could have written a play about that specific subject and set it in that time, but he chose to use the Crucible and the Salem witch trials as a metaphor. But my point is that in the late 1600s, witchcraft was a fear. In the America in the 1950s, communists were a fear. But to do a modern production in 2016 of this play, The Crucible, set in what appears to be a modern-day classroom with everyone going on about witches, makes absolutely no freaking sense to me at all. And I think it added nothing and distracted everything, and I really, really disliked it intensely. Also, somewhat less importantly, there are a couple of places during this production where things happen that could only be termed supernatural. And I do not understand the point of that, because the whole point of the play is supposed to be that there are no witches and there are no supernatural occurrences. So you have got me. I will say again, I liked all of the acting except Ben Whishaw as John Proctor, who I thought was completely miscast and almost totally at sea. He had a few nice moments, but there were other moments where I felt he just did not really have any comprehension of what was going on. The first conversation between he and Saoirse Ronan as Abigail, they are supposed to have had a history, and it should be a very, very fraught moment when they are alone together again for maybe the first time and talking. He did not seem remotely upset or trepidatious about this conversation at all. And I thought, what are you thinking? I cannot figure out what was going on there. And I guess Ivo van Hove is more concerned with anachronistic settings and just making the audience see how hard he's working as a director than working on something basic like having actors relate to the text. So I really, really disliked it very, very, very much.
So, Michael, are there parallels on the updating of The Crucible with the overall theme that was used in Fiddler on the Roof that you also disliked? Is that I see a theme here in your take on your philosophy on theater?
Well, I will say again, as I think I said last week, in terms of 1776, I think it almost shows a disrespect for the audience's intelligence to think that we have to see something in modern dress to understand how it relates to our lives. I mean, it's done very differently in this than in Fiddler. In Fiddler, there's just that moment at the beginning and at the end. So, but it is the same basic idea. And in 1776, of course, it was done throughout. I think people are smarter than that. And I think it's mostly about directors just wanting to flex their muscles and show how clever they can be or how clever they think they can be. I do think that it is a very different approach to the two of you from the bridge. Would you guys agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. At least I'm right about that. Yeah, that's just how I feel. And I understand.
You from the bridge for listeners, same director.
Yes, same director.
Yeah. Just I don't know if you had mentioned that. I didn't know if we took it out of context. So yeah, I tend to agree with much of what you're saying. There is that I think that things were done for
effect
more than moving the story forward. The blowing of tremendous amounts of trash onto the stage.
I mean, are we supposed to think at one? All right, let's say at one point, at a very, very fraught moment, the windows of the room fly open. All of this wind and smoke comes in, bringing in tremendous amounts of papers and trash and depositing it on the floor. And also, a beam of the ceiling dislodges and falls to the floor of the stage. Are we supposed to think that the other characters only think they see these things happening?
Is this in the text, Michael?
No.
Okay. So has the director decidedly taken the show in a different direction than Miller wanted?
I can only think his intention is that to show us what the people think they see when they get hysterical when they think that they see witchcraft at work.
Do you think it's possible that maybe during the rehearsal process that Blackbird was playing next door and mm-hmm. Jeff had thrown all the trash from his set onto their set?
Well, that would be one way to get rid of it.
Well, another possibility is simply that he's making a statement that the weather in Salem, Massachusetts can be really bad.
You just wait 15 minutes and it changes.
Yeah, it sure does.
Now, despite everything I said, this is one of the greatest plays ever written. Arthur Miller was such an amazing playwright. The only flaw I would say is maybe it goes on a little too long. It may make some points more times than necessary. One of the good things about this production was that it was condensed into two acts rather than three. So I think that helped the momentum. But I will never. I have seen several traditional productions of The Crucible, so I personally will live on those memories. But I feel bad for anyone who experiences it for the first time in this production, because I just think so much is lost.
So our good friend over at Time Out New York, David Cody, has ranked the 10 best plays by Arthur Miller, and he has Death of a Salesman at first, Crucible second, All My Sons, A View from the Bridge, Incident at Vichy, The Price, Ride Down Mount Morgan, After the Fall, The Creation of the World, and Other Business, and The Man Who Had All the Luck. Is off the top of your heads, I didn't prep you guys for that, but you know, do you think that those contain the top 10?
That sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, actually, to me too. I would. Who wouldn't take issue by switching one with a little higher and one lower?
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, no, that's a good list in the correct order.
So I will link to that in the show notes. If the listeners would like to agree or disagree and take a look at that list themselves, I'll put that in the show notes. So all three of us got down to the Public Theater to see Dry Powder. So, Peter, tell our listeners what Dry Powder is.
Well, I think it may be this generation's other people's money. 25 years ago, people from Wall Street were coming uptown 2 miles to go to the Minetta Lane Theater to see Other People's Money, which was all about hostile takeovers. And the play ran 1,000 performances, almost. And much of that had to do with the Wall Street crowd who never went to the theater, but this time they would make an exception. Now, of course, what we have here for Dry Powder at the moment is a limited run, but I am hoping that it gets its chance, too, to be able to appeal to the Wall Streeters, because here we are talking about a very similar issue, whether or not a company should be bought and what should be done with it. The person who's in charge is a guy named Rick, and yet the two people who are with him, two of his employees, who are they seem to be doing much more in giving each other opinions. Jenny is one and Seth is the other. And we meet Jenny first, and we think she's really quite the shark. But when Seth comes in, we realize that he's really the white shark, much more severe. And they really what's so amazing to me is that each of them insults the other so matter-of-factly. It reminded me of when I used to go to my cousin's house. I had two sets of cousins that had four people in the family, and they didn't. All these kids would, the brothers and sisters would insult each other like crazy, and it had no effect on them because they'd been insulted so much they didn't even bother saying "shut up." You know, it just rolled off their back, and that's what happens here. Insults just roll off their backs. They don't care what the other thinks. It doesn't matter. They don't hold back in the insults by any stretch of any imagination, and that's very interesting to me. The set is simply wooden blocks painted blue, but it reminded me of the set of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And I thought, yeah, they're children, you know. so I thought that was pretty interesting. Well, I don't know if you remember that TV show where the unfeeling TV host used to tell a contestant, "You are the weakest link, goodbye."
Yes.
You know, I mean, these people are in that vein, you know, so they're always doing that. Whether or not the situation turns out the way it it's expected to. I will leave that to the Wall Streeters. But I was a little surprised how it happened. And who emerges victorious struck me as surprising to me. I didn't expect it to play out the way it did. So that's always good, isn't it? And I will say that the people in it are quite fine. Claire Danes, who has that X-ray figure that Tom Wolfe noted the privileged women have in Bonfire of the Vanities, that X-ray. But this woman really has nerves of stained steel, you know, so she's very good there. John Krasinski, who's very good as Seth, all very cocky, hands in the pocket when he's making a point to indicate, you know, everybody knows this. Sometimes arms akimbo when he needs to really stress something that they don't have a total awareness of. Hank Azaria as the boss. Again, it's interesting to me that he's not as ferocious as they are. And I imagine that is indeed the intention of playwright Sarah Burgess, to show that when you get to the top, the people who are below you are the ones who are really more ferocious because they want to get in your position. There's one point, in fact, where Rick leaves the room and Seth moseys over and sits in at his desk. And it's kind of interesting when he comes back, the look that Rick gives him. Now, only 3/4 of the house will see that look because this is staged not in the round, but in the square and almost like boxing rings. So that's very apt as well. So directed by Thomas Kail. Yeah, you know, who's needless to say had a good year. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, you know, he's certainly involved with that show called Hamilton. So very nice to see that he can do this type of rapid fire thing and keep our interest. It's only about 85 minutes. There's no intermission. And I was really impressed by it, and I liked the way it looked, even though it was simply a simple set. The color blue was very pleasant to look at. So I'd recommend Dry Powder, but especially if you work way downtown.
Michael, what did you think?
You heard of theater in the round? I invented theater in the square.
Ah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
had a good seat.
That's right, yeah.
But of course, that's a funny line, but it doesn't really apply because we have seen many theaters in the square, which this is.
And I always thought that was a strange line, frankly, yeah.
Just sounds funny, you know.
I know,
sounds hilarious. It doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
But no, the staging was excellent in the square. I was lucky, very lucky. I saw the play on Wednesday evening, March 30th, and Hank Azaria had been out, I think, for at least two performances, including that matinee, because he was ill. And I guess, the play was open already by that point. Presumably, they may have understudies. I didn't actually check. I don't see anyone listed on the – maybe they don't have understudies. There are none listed on the company page. But even if they did, the amount of lines in this play, oh my God. I can understand how it would be really difficult to put anyone else in without copious rehearsals. So fortunately, I didn't have to deal with that. And Hank Azaria was there. I thought he was excellent. He actually coughed a few times during the show. So that's why I wasn't actually specifically told it was him who was ill, but I assume it was because he coughed a few times, but he got through it like a real trooper. I thought everyone was excellent. Claire Danes had an amazing moment where the fellow whose company they're thinking of buying, the company is a company that makes bespoke luggage. And the fellow's name is Jeff. And they're talking about how Jeff has a program at the company where everyone in the company volunteers, I think, every Sunday or every Saturday at some kind of, I don't know if it was a soup kitchen or something like that, just kind of doing good. And she, they tell this to Jenny, and she can't quite understand. She's like, I don't understand that anyone would do anything like that without getting anything out of it, just out of sheer humanity. So that was a really wonderful moment that she had. I thought that as short as it was, I thought that there was a little bit of repetition in it, but not to the point where it really was damaging. The writing was very, very sharp and very interesting. I found it really only maybe a few moments where I didn't know necessarily what was going on because I don't have a background in private equity or anything like that. I would say I got 95% of it, and the other stuff just went by quickly enough that it really didn't matter. I don't think this is a spoiler. There's a turnaround at the end that I didn't necessarily find 100% believable, but I think it was believable enough that it that I could accept it. So, and I think that's the point, really, maybe, that people have principles when they – people like to think they have principles when they're dealing with – tremendous amounts of money and in situations like Wall Street. And the question is, does everyone have a price? Does everyone have a price? And I guess that's what's answered in this play.
So as somebody who has worked for Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers,
yes,
on a few other things that I've done in the financial markets, and I mentioned before I was an economics major, so I didn't even think about that as we were prepping for this show. I found that a lot of this discussion was very interesting, and I almost was expecting that Rick, the character that Hank Azaria is playing, was that I expected that Claire Danes and John Krasinski were going to be figments of his imagination, the two sides of the argument for every single thing. And that didn't go that way. And that was a surprise twist because I thought that that was really what was going to happen, because I really didn't feel as though that Rick needed the Claire Danes and John Krasinski characters in order to run his business.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so I was thinking too much about this. And I really enjoyed the show. I thought that they were outstanding performances, and the uncomfortable nature that I felt within myself while watching it was not because the show was bad, but because, you know, my gut reaction to many of these things that the Claire Danes character would say on paper, absolutely, this is what you do to make more money. And on the flip side of it, the John Krasinski character is like, you know, but there's real people behind those numbers that you're going to ruin their lives.
Right.
And it's the everyday discussion that happens on Wall Street. And it's a very important topic to talk about, whether or not we make more money or whether we, you know, make less money in order to save the lives of people whose names you don't know, and in a lot of cases, names you don't care about. I think this is a very important show, and I hope that it has a longer life. I think that it's the way in which it's conceived and staged, meaning that four characters in a bare set makes it easily work in many other scenarios, and I hope that it gets done in many times. I don't know if it's necessarily a Broadway show. But let's see what happens with it. But dry powder is a Wall Street term for cash on hand. So it was really funny because I'm wondering more and more. You know, I had this whole thing that I meant to ask you about last week or the week before, the two of you, Michael and Peter, about what the hell does Blackbird mean? Do you guys know what Blackbird means? I had to do a lot of research on it to actually find out.
So you have an answer?
Yeah, I have an answer.
I'm ready.
Blackbird is English slang for jailbird.
Oh.
And this Blackbird, the show, was based upon what had happened with a Marine and a British girl. And it was written for the Edinburgh, it was commissioned by Edinburgh Festival. And so it was written by a British playwright who took this term Blackbird, which means jailbird, which is what the main character of Blackbird was convicted of statutory rape. And I was like, what the hell? Because I went through all of that thing and I had no idea what Blackbird, the title, meant, but I understood the show. So anyway.
Back to dry powder. Yeah. Isn't it interesting? Because it wouldn't dry powder then also mean basically the same as liquid assets?
Yes.
So isn't that interesting that it's the opposite, dry and liquid, being used to mean the same thing?
Yeah. Well, dry powder is explosive. And it but liquid assets and dry powder are used interchangeably, You know, dry powder is really cash on hand, and liquid assets are short-term securities that can be converted to cash quickly.
Oh, okay.
But again, you know, that aspect of it doesn't matter. But I think the term, the marketing dry powder with this cast, it does exactly what Peter says. You know, it brings the Wall Streeters who are not likely to go see a Broadway play, say, hey, I know that term, dry powder. I'm going to go see that.
May I ask if you found the turnaround at the end believable of the fellow whose company they're buying?
The Hank Azaria or the Senshi De Silva?
The one whose company they're buying.
Yeah. Right. Oh, no. I totally believe that.
You did believe it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I absolutely did believe it because at the end of the day, it achieved – I don't want to spoil this, but I don't think a lot of people are going to get to see it. It's a small theater and it's a limited run. But
movie stars.
Yeah. I don't think that I think that that's the way it mostly plays out, and that people are 99% of the people in that situation are self-interested, and they'd like to do the right thing, but if it comes to do the right thing for somebody else or do the right thing for themselves, they do the right thing for themselves. And so people always go for whatever puts more money in their own pocket. You know, and you see this with the Walton family at Walmart, and you see this with the Donald Trumps, and you see this with many, many other high finance people out there. You know, you see this with Steve Jobs was notoriously self-interested. And, you know, all throughout when Steve Jobs was in charge of Apple, Apple never, ever did corporate matching. They never did fundraising for others. You know, they were involved in the red campaign, which was Bono's campaign to raise money. But other than the red campaign, which was really a marketing campaign for Apple about making more money, Apple never did anything in the social area or raising money or corporate awareness that it does right now under Tim Cook. So I think that most people would have gone the same way as went in the in dry powder. And
it's just that character had made such a point to the opposite. But I guess, like I said before, I guess it's a question of what's your price.
Yeah, well, the thing is that if he could make all that money and protect his employees, then sure, I'm sure he wants to do that. But when it came down to making the money or protecting the employees,
right,
then it didn't. That wasn't surprising to me at all.
Gotcha. Yeah. And that was all a spoiler. So if people can retroactively go back and not,
yeah,
I said it at the beginning. So hopefully I'm covered.
All right. Next up, Peter went downstairs in the public to see Hungry. So Peter wanted to tell us about Hungry.
Yeah, this is a play by Richard Nelson, who in the last few years has given us the Apple plays about the Apple family. And now we're moving on to the Gabriel family. And I think he made a mistake as director in casting Marianne Plunkett and J.O. Sanders in the show. I begrudge them nothing for getting jobs. They're terrific people and terrific performers. They're a real-life couple. But because they were in the other plays, I guess there's going to be some confusion. People coming in who know the Apple plays and saying, oh, this is the same family? Where are the other people we got to know in those other plays? No, they're the only holdovers. Now, I will admit that in an age where the League of American Theaters say that a heavy theater goes four times a year, that there's an excellent chance that people did not see all three or even two or even one of the Apple plays, and this won't be an issue for them. So I will concede that point. But the play still winds up being disappointing to me because the other Apple plays dealt with big events. And, of course, plays are always good if they have big characters and or big events. Now, the Apple characters and the Gabriel characters are not big people. They're not movers and shakers like the people we talked about in Dry Powder. They work, you know, they make a living, they're good people, may they live to be 100, all that kind of stuff. But the thing was, the Apple plays always took place during big events. So there was the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, there was election night, that type of thing. Here, there's very, very little in terms of big events. Yes, we have an election coming up, which will be a big event. And, of course, none of us have ever lived through an election season as we have this one. I mean, this one's really bizarre, to say the least. And you would really think that there'd be a lot of talk about Hillary and Bernie and John and Donald and Ted. No. No, very little. I would say only about the last fifth of the play deals with that. Otherwise, it's just small talk, and very small talk, I'm sorry to say, and I'm waiting for them to get around to the main event of the election. So I'm very sorry that they don't get to it much faster, because I would like to hear what the Gabriels would say about the election. But what comes across here more than anything else is the Gabriels aren't nearly as interesting as the Apples.
All right. So let's move on to the next thing. Michael, tell us about Broadway by the Year, the Siegel Productions.
Oh, yes. Before we do, I just wanted to go back a few minutes and say that that line I quoted about theater in the square was from the producers. I don't think we mentioned that.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that somebody knew what we were talking about.
Which brings up an interesting point, Michael, and that is the fact that when the producers opened, of course, it was the mega hit of all time. And I don't think it's really turned out to be that. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if a lot of people don't remember the line and don't remember the show that well.
Especially because the movie was not that successful.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah. But the producer seems to have faded away in a way that most mega hits don't.
Yeah, well, I think we all agree that it turned out to be much more dependent on the stars than those particular stars than just about any other play I can think of.
Yeah. I think it sparked just at the right exact moment, and and it flamed out very quickly, but I loved every moment of it and thinking back to it, but I don't think of it very often.
I bet.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of stars, Broadway by the Year, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about it last week because we had 11 shows that we reviewed.
Yeah.
But this was actually Monday, the 28th of March, that I saw Broadway by the Year, the 1950s. At Town Hall, created, written, directed, and hosted by Scott Siegel, music director Ross Patterson. And this was, songs from musicals of the 1950s. The cast included Marilyn May, Josh Grizzetti, Luke Hawkins, Karen Akers, Douglas Ladner, Jill Pace, Jim Brochu, Jimmy James Sutherland, Lisa Howard, and Ryan Scobel.
What a good cast.
Yeah, no, it was a really great evening. And, of course, the 50s, I mean, they had to – God knows how they decided what to do and what not to do. It was such riches in the musical theater of the 1950s. Some of the highlights, some of the many highlights, Josh Grizzetti and Luke Hawkins did a tap dance routine, Soft Shoe, to Very Soft Shoes from Once Upon a Mattress. Jill Pace did Make the Man Love Me from A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Beautiful job. Doug Ladner, Stranger in Paradise. Marilyn May, Everything's Coming Up Roses. Oh, the last two numbers were Marilyn May, Everything's Coming Up Roses, and Lisa Howard, Climb Every Mountain, which just brought the house down.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, I'm glad they placed it there because there was nothing that was going to happen after that that was going to be, you know, equivalent. She did a beautiful, beautiful job with it. And they have coming up, Broadway by the Year has the 1960s on May 23rd. And then they're also doing one for the 70s. I don't have the date for that one, but mark your calendar for May 23rd if you can. These are much less expensive than any Broadway show or even off-Broadway show, I think you would see. And they're really, really well worth it. I know for a fact that Bryce Pinkham, who was our guest on the podcast a few weeks ago, is going to be in the 1960s one. He, when I asked him about it, he didn't yet know what he's singing, but I guess we'll see. And then the 70s one, as I said, is at some point after that. So go to the Town Hall website and you can find that out.
Michael, I found the 70s. It's June 20th, 2016. And as you mentioned, the 60s are May 23rd. So yes. I'll have a link to that stuff in the show notes. You know, when Scott Siegel started these many years ago, I was thinking, "Oh, this is a really good idea," but they run out of steam. He has not run out of steam.
No, he has not.
Well, sometimes now they do. They used to do. Well, it used to be Broadway by the Year, and it would be a specific year.
Yeah.
But then they ran out of years because they did so many. So now they do ranges, and it works just as well. It's really great. And Town Hall, as I'm sure I've said on many occasions, is a wonderful, wonderful hall that I'm sure a lot of theatergoers don't necessarily get to because of the type of programming they have. But Scott has been doing all of these Broadway-related, theater-related programs for a very long time now, and they're so, so worth it.
After the June 20th one, the 70s, let's see if we can get Scott on to talk about these, because I'm sure he's with, you know, all the other things that he does, he and his wife do, and the Tony Awards coming up and all the Drama Desk and various other things. I think we'll try to get him after that madness, and we'll talk about this over the summer. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yes.
All right. So let's wrap up for today. Do you guys have anything else you want to mention before we go?
I'm all set.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that we each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your Android device, and get a stream to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including the Broadway by the Year and the Best Plays of Arthur Miller by David Cody, things like that. So, Peter, what's the answer to last week's trivia?
Well, I mentioned that in the 70s, on two separate occasions, 45 RPM singles were made of two show songs, one on each side of the record, songs taken directly from the 33 and a third RPM original cast album. I don't mean anybody covered it. I don't mean that famous performers of the day like Bobby Sherman came in and recorded the song. I mean, they actually took it from the original cast album and put it on a 45. And as I mentioned, the 70s was the first decade when the recording industry was starting to distance itself from musicals. So it didn't want to say on each side of the 45 from the original cast album. They wanted to prevent people from knowing that. So both singles used the name of the shows and pretended that these were the names of the groups that were singing. In case you're finding this hard to follow, I gave an example. If the songs had been Little Hands from Anya, the record would claim that the group singing it was actually named Anya. All to mass that it came from this now dreaded animal called the Broadway musical. Okay, so two of these happened. And one of them was Godspell, because Day by Day and Bless the Lord were released as a 45 RPM record. And what happened? It did pretty well. I wonder if it would have done as well if people knew that it actually came from a show. Day by Day, of course, was the more popular of the two. But still, the fact remains that it was something that people were getting to know. And I dare say that having the original cast do the show, the song, rather than having people come in and do it for them, added something to it. At least I insist, because I want to think that way about Broadway. Well, in that case, off Broadway, to be fair. Mm-hmm. The other one is far more obscure. I mean far more obscure, because the original cast album that we're talking about was never released. East. It was a musical called Shelter by Gretchen Cryer and Nancy Ford. And Columbia recorded it, but then decided, the show's not running. Why bother putting it out? But for some reason, they put out a single of two songs from Shelter, which were really very surprising to me. And those of us who were there in those days certainly worked very hard to get this 45 with Woke Up Today and Fly, Fly Away on the Other Side. So so that's the answer to that. And while a lot of people certainly got the Godspell one, Robert Lobiondo was the first. Nobody got the Shelter, and I'm not terribly surprised about it. So it was a little tough. So this week, okay, what's the inside joke here in why these Songtime songs are in this order? Send in the Clowns, Happily Ever After, Everybody Ought to Have a Maid, I Know Things Now, Losing My Mind, and Anyone Can Whistle. This is an inside joke. Go find it.
I'm going to have to find that out next week because I have no idea.
It'll take me all week.
Yeah. All right. So if you have an idea of what to do that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. And if you do not know that, tune in next week and we will let you know the answer. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.